interesting in the first program, and the opportunity to be here and present our work. Second, I want to thank Charles Bardi, who has the music lab of Ismaila Kapata and I would like to acknowledge my collaborators and my group, especially Gala, who did most of the numerical work which I'll be presenting. And my current collaborators on the Keldysh field theory side, Jonathan Keeling, and on the stochastic simulation side, Francesca and Jacobo. And I'll be also comparing our results to some of the experimental data done in the Yamamoto group. So the question that we want to pose is actually much broader than polariton, exciton, or other BEC. We can just ask a general question: what is the nature of phase transition between order and disorder states, order and disorder phases in two-dimensional system where phase fluctuations are very strong? However, in systems which are out of equilibrium, which are driven and dissipative. And this can apply to a wide class of systems, and in particular, we want to hold it in the context of normal to superfluid phase transition. We want to ask the question, what is the nature of normal to superfluid phase transition in quantum fluids, such as helium, protons, or polaritons, but in the non-equilibrium given context. So before I start on non-equilibrium, let's just in a few minutes to revise what we know about equilibrium systems. And I don't pretend to be an expert, there are much better experts in this room, but at some point there was somewhat a debate whether the transition from normal to superfluid in, let's say, cold atoms, RBC, BKT, or perhaps something else. And after some theoretical works, I believe it has been established that Bose-Einstein condensation is possible only in non-interacting system. No matter the traffic potential, even arbitrarily weak interaction destroy BEC. This has been confirmed in the context of cold atoms by the Dalibard group a long time ago, and there is also a recent paper, PRL, by Zoyan, which shows clearly. Work of PRL 2015 shows that even if you go to arbitrary almost zero interaction, it's still one has a BKT, which then connects in the limit of exactly zero interactions to the BEC. So for the BKT, things are known. The first order correlation function decay algebraically with some exponent which one can obtain from relatively simple calculations of looking at collective phase fluctuations. Even there is no need for vortices to establish this exponent. However, there is an upper bound of that exponent as you cross the phase transition, there is a phenomena of vortices proliferating and binding, and this sets an upper bound for that exponent in equilibrium, which is 1/4. So now we can ask the questions, what about non-equilibrium systems? And that's a natural question to ask in any photonic cases, because no matter how good your cavity is, even if you have the best cavities in the world, still they will have a finite lifetime for photons, and you have to replenish the population by some external drive. So the generic Hamiltonian you have to think is an open system. You have some system Hamiltonian, system Bath Hamiltonian, and the Bath Hamiltonian, which express this drive and decay mechanism. And several different models have been used in the context of polariton condensation, but the important ingredient is to have the photonic modes, which are then coupled to some matter component. So the phi here can be either a boson, or it can be a fermion pair, it can be a two-level system, a spin, and you have some interactions between the matter components. So the photons as such do not interact, but because they interact with the matter and matter interacts with itself, you have an effective interaction between photons. And the wide classes of Hamiltonians can be considered in the context of exciton polaritons, with psi being a boson two-level system, spin, alpha being a disorder site in the disorder potential, or alpha being a momentum. Now, because we want to describe this driven dissipative nature, we have to, one way, not a unique way, but one way is to develop a Keldysh field theory for that problem, and that's what we did already a long time ago. So you heard a lot about Kellner's field theory over a series of talks here, but the essence of that is that if you want to look at non-equilibrium steady state, you need to establish not only the retarded advanced Green's function, which gives the density of states, but you also need to establish the Kellner's Green's functions, which gives your distribution. And this distribution may be what, maybe thermal, if the thermalization processes are fast, or maybe very far from thermal, depending on your problem. So now, what happens in that model, and it doesn't really matter which one you take, is as you increase some control parameter, for example, the drive, the intensity of the drive, you can also decrease the intensity of the decay, although, of course, in experiments, it's much easier to increase the density of the drive. So with this control parameter, you have a phase transition. We don't know yet what it is, but there is a phase transition. So how do you can understand that? So if you look at the poles of various Green's functions, so the poles of the retarded or advanced Green's function will give you the spectra. And if you look at your distribution may also have poles. So if you think of a Bose-Einstein distribution, it has a divergence at chemical potential. And so if you take, let's say, atomic case, you increase the density of atoms, the ground state is more or less constant, and then you increase chemical potential, and when chemical potential crosses this mode, you have a BEC. If my polaritons were completely equilibrium, I would have a very similar picture, with the only difference is that they are not, polaritons are composite particles, so you have a lower and upper polariton and photon, so your Green's functions have more poles, but it doesn't, the higher energy state does not matter, and you really have exactly the same behavior as for atoms. However,
sorry.
Yes?
What's the left axis on these graphs?
Left?
Yeah.
Is energy.
Thank you.
Yeah, so this is just poles of, the poles of the retarded Green's functions give you states, and poles of the distribution is something like a chemical potential for bosonic distribution. Of course, your distribution may not have poles, but the Bose-Einstein one has, and that's so why it's dramatic? Because if your distribution is divergent and your density of state is divergent, the total number of particles diverges. So you have a phase transition here. So you can trust everything on the normal side, but if you go to this side, there is something else happening and we have to address that.
So what is zeta?
Zeta?
Psi
would be a pole of the retarded Green's function, which gives you states. So if you take a polariton Green's function, it will give you lower polariton, if you give you upper polariton, and also there is a pole where photon energy is. I mean, that's just a decay.
Then what is mu effective?
A mu effective would be a pole of the distribution function. So you can compute a distribution function here from your Keldysh field theory, you can compute it. And you can look at it, and sometimes it doesn't have a pole, which means that it's very non-bosonic. You created some highly non-equilibrium state which has nothing to do with bosons because it doesn't diverge anywhere. Or it might have a divergence, and if it's a Bose-Einstein distribution, you would have a divergence at chemical potential. So that's just kind of equilibrium BEC. And when you have a system which has strong drive and strong decay, your n from omega may have nothing to do with the Bose-Einstein distribution, but we notice that as you increase the drive, it develops also this divergence, so it's kind of like becoming kind of like bosonic one, and when this divergence crosses the normal mode is when you have that phase transition. It's actually, it's a little bit offside the talk, but it's actually interesting to see what happens if I keep driving the system a lot. So as on the David Snow talk, he was showing the second threshold, namely if you take a cavity and you just madly drive it, you have a normal laser. You'll have a population inversion and a normal laser. And there is somewhat a difference if you take a really very highly driven regime, you will see that your distribution function has no poles. So it's really very non-bosonic. But it has a pole only at this one point here, when the phase transition happens, but doesn't have a precursor of that. It's not like here that it's still there is no phase transition, but still your distribution develops a pole, and then it crosses the normal mode. Here it crosses the normal mode, and only then it has a pole. So there is a kind of a difference between a kind of a laser regime and a kind of non-equilibrium condensation regime.
Can you calculate your distributions on the coherent side as well?
Yes, we do.
And
but
what is the qualitative difference between normal and coherent from the viewpoint of Green's functions?
Okay, so if you calculate on the normal side, you just get your polariton luminescence. So you have a lower polariton and upper polariton.
I understand that.
And
normally.
Formally.
Yeah.
Okay, so formally, I will go to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So in the non-content side, that's just enough to take a Bogoliubov of like fluctuations, and you'll get, just taking a second order fluctuations in everything. If you are on the kind of condensed side, I don't want to call it BC because it's not, but on the kind of ordered side, we must take the fluctuations better. And you can parameterize that in the amplitude and phase fluctuations. And the lowest order, which would make sense, we are not taking it to all orders, like what Sebastian is presenting, but the lowest order, which would make sense, is basically taking amplitude fluctuations to second order and phase fluctuations to all order, but the gradients of phase to second. So it doesn't matter the details of here, it's just I wanted to show a structure that basically if you expand, so those are the correlators phase amplitude, phase, and so on, and we compute a lesser Green's function, because this is you can compute Keldysh and retard it in practice, but then you rotate because this corresponds to the luminescence. So Fourier transform of that is really the luminescence they measure. That's the first thing. And also, this is really G1. So G1 they measure is also the lesser. The Keldysh and the retard it is not something measurable. So if you expand that to first order, you would see that you will have like a condensate. There will be of diagonal long range order coming from this rho 0 times 1. But now here you have these phase fluctuations here, which of course will if you go to infinitely large times and distances, it will decay to 0. So how does this relate to what Sebastian was talking about? Well, so we include those we have included. I mean, this is an old work. I hope I will reach the time of the recent work. But this includes amplitude fluctuations to some order, and the phase fluctuations, not exactly, but of course to higher order than Bogoliubov. What to say, if I expand to the first order, that I will obtain the usual Bogoliubov, a condensate plus condensate depletion and fluctuations coming from Bogoliubov quasiparticles. If I take the phase fluctuations to higher order, I obtain something else. I obtain a broadening of my condensates, what to say, if I look at the frequency space, or some decay of correlations at large distances. So we do not take the phase fluctuations to all orders, because gradient of phase are only to second order, but we include amplitude fluctuations better. So if we wanted to calculate things which they see in experiments, like a condensate fraction, luminescence spectra, it's somehow better. So if you want to take a smaller system in which this lambda term in the KPZ maybe is not so important, then in the amplitude space we are better. Well, then of course you can compute this luminescence, and as you go above the transitions you get this diffusive behavior coming from the Goldstone mode, and the upper and the lower here those branches, and this Gauss branch has been now observed, which in polariton system you can also look at higher energies, looking upper polariton, some excitons weakly coupled to light, and so on. So you can compute all of these details. You can also look at G1, and of course within that treatment, well, it wasn't obvious at that time, but we got a power law decay of both the space and the time correlation functions. Now with the power law being given by some combination of pump decay and density, so that the system is not thermal in a way, that you don't have a thermal distribution in the system, your distribution may be far from thermal, but still you obtain a power law decay, which will be set by your pump and decay processes. This has been observed, so some years later, this has been observed in a Yamamoto group at Stanford, where by changing the pump intensity, he observed a crossover from exponential decay to power law decay in space. However, the puzzling fact was that the exponent of that power law was larger than an upper bound for equilibrium. So upper bound for equilibrium is a quarter. That was already 4 times larger. So we wanted to understand that. But to recap, what we knew already on the basis of the Keldysh field theory is that while in equilibrium there is this upper bound, In an equilibrium system, it wasn't clear even when we have whether we would get a power law, because we have these diffusive modes which are different than Bogoliubov modes, but we got them. And you can still assume that your thermalization processes are very, very fast in comparison to drive and decay. If you assume that, then the fact that the modes are different does not matter. You still get the same power law as equilibrium. So it's really the fact what kind of power law you get is probing the distribution. It's not probing the kind of modes of your system. You can also choose one, which is the drive and decay is relatively strong with respect to thermalization, and then you get that this coefficient depends on pumping noise over NS, which was kind of nice to see, because as you increase your drive in those experiments, you increase the noise, and this thing was going up with the noise. And independently, I mean, we have calculated that in that paper for bosonic model using Kaldor's field theory. You can also obtain exactly the same results using Langevin equations, which was done in Jacobo group. So now the question is, how do we understand this upper bound? Is it an artifact in experiment? Why it is that it's larger? So we wanted to address that. So we wanted to look at the phase transition. So going close to the phase transition, because this is of course larger the closest you come to the phase transition. So we wanted to treat those fluctuations really quite correctly. So one can ask, what about the KPZ physics? So Sebastian talk, which we learn. Let's say we would like to include fluctuations to all orders, but at the same time, we do not want to forget about amplitude fluctuations, because close to the phase transition, close to the when the densities are very small, that may not be fully justified, and we would like to treat them as well. And moreover, I have to so basically there is no magic. I mean, you can analytically, you can only go as far as you can go. You can do what we did, and then you have a better description of a certain time. You can do what Sebastian did, and you have just exact equation for the phase, but nothing about the amplitude. So if you want to combine that, and moreover, if you want to even add vortices there, so account the fact that this phase variable is a phase, and it's a compact variable. One way is to look at the numerical approach to treat those phase and amplitude fluctuations exactly. And before I show that, I want to ask that we didn't like that model. Yeah, so this model has been used initially, and it was very useful to describe a lot of hydrodynamic properties, such as solitons, vortices, vortex lattices. But if you want to look at from the point of view of phase transitions, it has problems. So one problem it has, of course, if you look at that, there is no frequency dependent in the drive. So you are injecting particles and all energies up to infinity with the same strength. This is not physical, but never mind physics. If we want to think even mathematically, this is ultraviolet divergent. And actually, we realized there is even worse than that. If you want to look with Jacobo and Nick Lukakis, we are in the middle of a project of looking of sweeps across the transition. So looking at the Kibble-Jurek mechanism as you go across the transition, because from the Kibble-Jurek mechanism, you can learn a lot about the phase transition itself. So you know that in the Kibble-Jurek, you have the adiabatic impulse and adiabatic regime, and you have the correlation then diverging as you approach the phase transition from below. So it's important that your correlations are being able to build up also when you go from below the phase transition. So your correlation then diverges. If you take this model and you look at the below transition, so you take sine modulus psi to zero, then you can compute correlations, and it will just be noise correlations. So you have like just very short correlations, and then you have a jump into when you go to the phase when you have a non-zero psi. So it's not really suitable to look at the Kibble-Jurek physics from that model. So one can fix it. One can just put frequency dependence in that bit, and some functional forms has been proposed both by Jacobo and Jonathan Keating. However, it's a little bit guessing. Like, okay, we guess some frequency dependent just so that the problem is convergent, but there is a very little resemblance that phase that this functional form can have with experiments. So we found a better system, which is probably not well known, but it's actually very nice. So I wanted to explain, because it has a lot of advantages for looking at the phase transition. So it's the polarizon system in so-called optical parametric oscillator regime. So what it means that basically instead of driving this thing very high in energy, creating hot electron hole pairs, which then they have to undergo millions of scattering with excitons, exciton phonons, polariton exciton, and God knows what to go down to the bottom of polariton dispersion, you are injecting that exactly at the polariton dispersion. So you have your drive is a coherent drive with a fixed kp and fixed omega p, and if you do it with not very large intensity, you only have a pump state, which is somewhat boring because you by hand are breaking symmetry, so you obtain a gapped spectrum and there is no phase freedom in your system. Although a lot of experiments are only in this coherently driven regime, and you can also look at hydrodynamics, it's a very interesting problem. But from the point of phase transition, there is no phase transition. So you have to drive stronger. When you drive stronger, there is a phenomena that two polaritons scatter and they occupy signal in either state. And now, the pump state, that the pump phase is fixed by the pumping process, but one phase in the problem is free. So if you choose it to be a signal phase, then the idler phase is a mirror image of the signal via pump. So you have a fixed sum, but the difference between signal and idler phases is free. So you spontaneously break U1 symmetry, you have a gapless spectrum, and if you compute excitation spectrum of that problem, you have a diffusive Goldstone mode, exactly the same as in the case of incoherently pumped system. However, the advantage is that very cheaply, because you can write this, everything is here, and you can measure essentially all of the parameters of the system. So it's really, you can relate to experiment very easily. So basically, these are exciton photons. You have exciton-exciton interaction, exciton-polariton interaction. You have a coherent drive of excitons, and you have some incoherent decay of photons. So it's very ab initio. You can relate one-to-one between your calculations and experiment, which has an advantage, but also the rate, the scattering rate now from the pump state to signal state depends on energy and momentum, but it's already built in into your theory. Yeah, so you have a system which does not have any of these pathologies and ultraviolet divergences of the previous model. Another interesting point to note here is that directly, if you look at that, there is no nonlinear term when you have I in front. So there's no. You have to remember that for KPZ physics to be important, you need to have a term which is I B gamma modulus psi square. Here we don't have it directly, but our expectation is that if you just look at the signal and kind of eliminate adiabatically those two, you will generate those terms. So that's probably what's going to happen. However, this system is very anisotropic. When you break a symmetry, if you pump with a given wave vector, you have a symmetry along this wave vector, and then perpendicular to that. So your dispersion is very different in one direction than in the other direction. It's a very anisotropic problem. And now it's actually a work in progress because we can, of course, we have developed the Keldysh field theory for that, and we can also make one step further to look at the KPZ equation and see whether actually for that system, whether it falls in the usual Gaussian saddle point because it's so anisotropic, or whether it will fall in the KPZ point. So this is an open problem to which I don't know the answer. However, we can just simulate it with a brute force. Yeah, you can do it. You include everything by doing that. I mean, at least everything to that semi-classical level, which we are all discussing. So what we do, you can write down those equations, which are now equations of motion for exciton and photon fields with interactions, exciton and exciton-photon interaction, drive, and noise. Where it comes from, depending whether you're quantum optician or condensed matter theorist, you might want to derive it in a different way. If you are quantum optician, you just take the Hamiltonian we wrote before, you write the master equation, you compute a Wigner, you translate master to Fokker-Planck equations, ignoring first order derivative. So you are throwing away some of the entanglement in your system. We are after semi-classical description, and then has been derived here. And or if you don't like master equations, you can start from Kelder's field theory, it's equivalent, and you can ignore RG Legrand terms as was done for this incoherent driven system in the same way, and you will obtain that description for the opium.
Have you now assumed, I didn't understand it, that you pump at a fixed angle, or are you assuming some kind of a pumping along a ring?
So in that work, we assume fixed angle, because that's...
anisotropy is important.
Yes, anisotropy is important. We have pumped on the ring as well for the mean field. We did some work on pumping on the ring and obtained some interesting vortex lattices there, but that's, I won't talk about it here. So it's possible to pump on the ring. I mean, I have to say that this OPO configuration was popular at some time. You know better than me, but I guess I think in this context, probably Jeremy Bamberg group was one of the strongest. And then, but still, there are experiments now, mainly in Luis Vigna group in Madrid and Daniele Sanvito in Lecce. So there are still experimentalists who are working with this OPO because it's very nice for looking at superfluid phenomena. You can put an obstacle in the middle of that and you can change your wave vector very easily and you can generate currents at any time. So it's not some, it's not a theoretical invention. I mean, there has been a lot of work on that. But by doing these numerics, of course, we are including large fluctuations. At the moment, we are not eliminating amplitude to second order. We are calculating just numerically. So this equation, so this would be, for Sebastian, that would be a starting point. This equation would be a starting point. He would ignore amplitude fluctuation and derive equation for the phase. We just numerically attack it. So amplitude and phase fluctuations are included to all orders. And phase is a phase. So vortices are present there. This method has been used, so Trachyty-Wigner has been used for atoms. However, it means something else for atoms. If you try to derive it for atoms, you have third-order derivative, which you ignore, but you don't have a second-order derivative. So your equation does not have a noise term. It's really a deterministic equation, just with the noise in the initial condition. Here we really have a stochastic equation to solve, and any observable would be a Monte Carlo average over those noise path. Okay, so... Now we, in the last 30 minutes, I go to results. So what do we have? So we start the system, so you switch on the drive, and you wait very long so that we are looking at the steady state. In all this work, we are interested in the steady state. And if you take your wave function, so now you have a two-dimensional wave function, x, y, and t, and you Fourier transform, you obtain this spectrum, which is energy and momentum, and you see you have a clearly 1, 2, 3 peaks. It's actually very difficult to show it because these peaks are really dominant. So here it's a kind of cut across that in the logarithmic scale, and you see you have a very strong signal pump in either state. Now if you take just that, filter out that part, that's also how they do an experiment, you see that you have some vortices, antivortices, so blue and red correspond to vortex antivortex. Yes?
Sorry. Is this at K, what K is this? The lower peak?
So lower peak is close to zero.
But not zero?
So if you analytically expand, you can, if you do analytics with OPO, you can choose it to be zero, and then the other one is a 2 KP. If you do numerically, you are including all possible k's because you're just numerically solving psi x, y.
Yeah.
And it's essentially impossible to fix your... You'd have to... Maybe it's possible, but you would have to really work very hard to fix your kp and omega p such that it will exactly go into k as equal zero state. And that's happening in experiment. If you want to have exactly k as equal zero, at least I was told by Daniele, it's impossible. You always have a little bit of ks. So here in our simulations also, it came out that there is a little bit of KS. So there is, so signal is not exactly at K is equal to zero.
I was rather wondering, can you actually control it? It doesn't need to be K equals zero. Could you control it?
No, you can.
K equals some value.
Yes.
Experimentally in practice.
It's not easy to precisely say, okay, I want it to be exactly like that, and what's because it's a nonlinear system which Kp is important, omega p is important, and the intensity is important. So in your numerics, if you do a lot of runs, you can kind of have some phase diagram, but it's, yes, Monique?
Why you call that homocyte?
No, I didn't call it condensed.
Even if you put quote, why you
they
put that?
They call it condensed?
In the quote. Why? Even if it's not in the minimum, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's a you have U1 symmetry breaking, you will have a long range coherence, as you see. Yeah, find another name, but it's somewhat quasi ordered state. Yeah, it's superfluid. You can calculate superfluid fraction. You can compute longitudinal and transverse response, and you find them different. So there is some superfluid fraction. So the name, I don't insist because it's not a Bose-Einstein condensate. So now we want to look at the steady state at different drive powers. So if you change the drive, but it's not changing this in time. It's like I change my drive to strong, I wait for a long time for the system to converge, and I look at the steady state. And this is just increasing the drive. So the underlying colors is the phase map. So you see that as you increase the drive, the phase becomes more ordered. And the dots, the black and red, are vortices and antivortices. So as you go across, this is a single shot. So as you go across the transition, you see that you'll see the overall decreasing number of vortices and pairing. And finally here, you only have pairs. And if you insist of going higher, you will have no vortices whatsoever. You'll just have perfect phase. So one can ask, okay, maybe we're starting from some peculiar steady state. This is a driven system. You have a drive and decay. You have to see whether initial conditions matter. And so we checked. Yeah, there is no response. I can run it from coming slide. Okay? So why it's happening like this? Just to start this dynamic. Okay, we may not just ignore this the dynamic.
We can sit there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So basically, let's think of like the most far away initial conditions you can imagine. So either you can start from completely white noise, so you don't have anything in your system, and you start the drive. So it would be like in atoms, adding atoms to your system. And another initial condition, the second one, is let's say I solve the mean field dynamics for that, so that I have a completely coherent state, and then I add slowly the noise. So it would be like raising the temperature in the case of atoms. And moreover, I can think of another scenario where when I drive only in some region, and I have a region with no drive. So that would be sink for vortices. Because we were thinking that, vortices are topological objects. They cannot just disappear. They have to vortex, have to fight an anti-vortex and annihilate. So it might be, if you couple it to some reservoir of vortices, this thing, it might happen quicker. And what we find, it doesn't matter. We start from this four, we come up even with other initial conditions. It doesn't matter what you do. You always end up in the same state, basically. So, well, it's a good news and bad news. I mean, the thing is that this system has a unique steady state. It doesn't matter what.
So what's the parameter plotted on the upper plot?
This is number of vortices. This is a single realization, and it's number of vortices. So overall, you have some noise. You have to average, but at the end, you see it comes to the same. And if you wait long enough, you see that these pictures are essentially the same vortices, although you start from a completely different one. I won't have any more animation, so.
Just.
So I think now we'll be fine. So I mean, just quickly, this is now average over noise, so you don't have this noisy behavior because you average over 100 of noisy path, and then you have to run in time for quite a long time in comparison. I mean, polariton lifetime here is a few picoseconds. We're running for nanoseconds, and you see that this is the signal density, this is number of vortices, and colors correspond to the same conditions, but if you have like a solid line and a dashed line, corresponds to different initial conditions. So even if you take a different initial condition, still you are converging to the same state, even on average. I skip that. I mean, this is just a convergence issue. So we can look at from the point of view of phase diagram. Let's say I want to see how this transition happens as I change my drive intensity. And this orange line would be on the mean field level. So on the mean field level, if I increase my drive, I develop this signal state, and will be zero to start with, and then on the mean field level, of course, you have a sharp transition. When you do these Wigner simulations, what happens is that the transition is smeared out. Yeah, you don't go from like zero to finite, but it's smeared out as expected by fluctuations. And it happens later, so this kink here is later. It's interesting to note that a lot of properties which we can compute have a kink in exactly the same place. So this is the signal density. So what's to say, if you want to call it a kind of quasi-condensate, it's a quasi-condensate density. And this is a number of vortices, you know, on the logarithmic scale. And this is a distance. So if you compute a distance between vortex and anti-vortex and divide it by a distance between vortex-vortex plus vortex-anti-vortex, so basically if the vortices are not paired, that would be 1. If the vortices are totally paired, it would be 0. So you also go, this is a logarithmic scale, so you go to binding and overall decrease in the number of vortices. One thing to note is that this transition is very narrow in pump powers. Yeah, we're looking at this whole region where you go from essentially lot of vortices to 0 vortices is a 4% Erant threshold. It's not so narrow if you plot it as a function of polariton density. So, I mean, when I presented this talk in some conference in Ventura, the experimentalists were asking me, okay, you're presenting everything in dimensionless numbers. What does it mean? What densities we are talking about? And this is the densities we are talking about. So we are thinking of between 2 polaritons per micron squared to 20 polaritons per micron squared. So this transition is happening over one order of magnitude in the real terms. And by the way, the numbers here are for, just because we got used to those numbers simulating a lot of things for Daniele Sanvito, so it's basically parameters of his structures. So now the next thing to look is, as you go across this transition, what would be the behavior of G1? And that's what we got. So this is G1 as a function of a distance. And this is more or less this higher point, so 3% above threshold. It fits very well. So the fit is the power law. So these curves fit very well, the power law. It's an extremely high correlation coefficient. This one is first, which still fits a better power law, but it's still already exponential. It's already comparable. And that one will fit exponential decay. So we have this crossover between the power law and exponential decay with powers. I mean, the largest we found was around 1.2. And while, I mean, one can still question whether this one is power law or exponential, those curves are pretty well described by a power law, and those are still much larger than a quarter. So exponent can exceed 1/4 clearly. So what's the news for experiments? There was experiments measuring G1 in OPO. So there is one experiment in Louis Vigna group, which basically reported a constant. So one could say, okay, we have this phase transition, which is a BEC, because we jump from an exponential decay to a completely full coherence. You have a finite system, you could think, I mean, in polariton, maybe not everyone is familiar with this debate in cold atoms, that doesn't matter whether it's finite, trapped, whatever, you don't have a BEC in 2D. If you look, the size of the system is 60 microns, so that would be here on this plot, and this is at 3% above threshold. This one is more or less 20% above threshold. So really, to observe that, you have to be much closer to threshold, and you have to look at the larger system. So one question which we had from a referee, and that was also in light of probably, I don't know if you are aware, but there are also reports of a larger exponent than a quarter in atomic gases in a trap. Yeah, so one question is, okay, maybe it's a finite size effect, that the function is larger than a quarter. So we studied that as a function of a system size, and here you have to appreciate those are the huge systems. I mean, the largest polariton experiments are of the order of 50 microns, so this is 10 times larger. So we run these calculations. That was quite painful because, I mean, we have a resolution of 1 micron in the simulation, so you run that here, and you see that, I mean, we're not bad. It's quite well converged already to a given value, but moreover, as you increase the system size, what we are getting even nicer phi to the power law. So if you by eye even look at phi to the power law for that point and compare the correlation coefficient, it's becoming even a nicer phi to the power law, and it goes to higher values, which is to be expected. Larger system has less coherence. So we concluded that the fact that it's larger than a quarter is not an artifact of the finite size. And to comment on possibility for KPZ, again, this is in a model which is not clear whether KPZ should show up. But if it should show up, it's not showing up yet. Yeah, and this is 10 times the larger system size. And moreover, it's quite a bad cavity. Yeah, it's not a cavity what David Snow has. It's 0.1 MeV is the lifetime of the photons, which is actually quite a bad cavity. I mean, I don't think one can even get much of this superfluid phenomena in that bad cavity. So, So I just leave it. I mean, so to conclude, we show that phase transition in driven systems are of the BKT type. Yeah, that despite the strong drive, decay and dissipation in the system is still the mechanism still to the vortices binding and unbinding. However, there is a difference, and this difference is that a larger exponent of the power law decay are possible, and that has been clearly observed in experiment, and also clearly demonstrated in the simulations, which include phase and amplitude fluctuation to all of this. So, in some sense, you can think whichever one to choose, but you can think about it that this phase is either more robust, or more disordered. Yeah, to distinguish between the two, one has to compute a bit more things, but basically you can allow a larger amount of collective fluctuations in the system before vortices start proliferating and destroying the phase completely. And the message is that, yes, in polaritons there is definitely not BEC. So the phase transition is definitely not of the BEC type. If anything, it's of the BKT type. But to show it, one has to go to closer to the transition and in the larger systems. Thank you for your attention.
So in your second system, you didn't include at all phonons, is that right, in your model?
Phonons?
In this bumped system. Because, I mean, if I remember correctly, I mean, especially if you do parametric down conversion there, I mean, you get actually, especially if you have equal energy scattering or so, you get a lot of very rapid phonon-induced defacing or scattering in your periaison. And I was wondering if this plays a role in your case, or...
No, so here the thing which we've included is the decay of the photons from the cavity, yeah, and the parametric process, so the interaction between polaritons. Yeah, we have not included other interactions. So there could be other defacing channels, which means that it will make the thing even worse for coherence, but it might widen the region of the transition. So yes, we could put some other defacing mechanism. Yeah, of course, we put just one. Just a point of principle to see what's going on. You can put other defacing if you want it.
Yeah, but do you know under experimental condition are the phonons then much slower than?
Yeah, the phonons will be definitely much slower than the polariton lifetime. So that those are the nanosecond scale. The polariton lifetime is picosecond scale. So the defacing coming from the lifetime is larger than that one. Phonons, but yeah, one could include it and see what corrections would it make the phase diagram. I don't think one, I don't think that if you add more of the phasing mechanism, it would change the physics. It would just increase or decrease the space of the phase diagram of the BKT, let's say.
Might influence the idler dynamics, but that should not matter to you, right? I mean, the phonons, interactions with phonons, because the idler excitations are at high momentum in more exciton-like states.
Yes.
But that should not, you're only focusing on the signal.
Yes.
And I think all the results qualitatively do not depend on the line width of the different modes. So if by chance you have a much faster decay, I think what one has to do is to increase the line width of the three modes, so perhaps just change the threshold point.
Mm. Yeah, but performance would qualitatively, I mean, they change the distribution and not lead just to decay, so I think it's a little bit different. Mechanism. Yeah, it's not just the same line having
but a we have line. We have processes which fix the distribution, and this is the nice part,
yeah,
which are not obvious because they just come naturally because you have exciton-exciton scattering in there. So you actually start populating these signal states, and this population is momentum and energy dependent. So that's why you're populating this state down there and not some other state. Yes, so you have this mechanism. Yes, if you include phonons, there will be some degree of dephasing and probably some degree of thermalization, which would, I guess, influence all the numbers, but I don't think there is any kind of... Yes?
So what is then the reason for these larger exponents, larger than 1/4 prism? I mean, you established it, but is there a physical understanding?
No, so the thing, what it means, of course, I said it already, but I repeat, it means that you can put more collective fluctuations into the system before you put vortices. So somehow this external drive is exciting those fluctuations, and those fluctuations, we also observe slowing down. So if we want, I didn't go through the numerics, but if you numerically simulate, as you were very close to the transition, you have a critical slowing down. You really have to run on the best computers forever to really have a convergence. And the phase degree of freedom is converging much, much more slowly than the vortices. So in some sense, maybe the system is disturbed all the time, and the phase degree of freedom close to the transitions really have a very slow response time, slower than the vortices, then somehow you can inject more of those phase fluctuations before, because the phase fluctuations are not harmful. They just make your exponent larger, but they will still leave you within the power law decay. It's the vortices which give you the exponential decay. And somehow those vortices are equilibrated faster than the collective fluctuations close to the transition. That's what we observe.
And Sebastian, and then last question, Jake.
We discussed it briefly, but this model that you took there, would you have the situation where essentially this Goldstone mode has also this drift term instead of only the diffusion? And does it have anything to do with this, so to say, slightly shifted KS? Because that can, of course, also influence this low momentum physics.
Yes, so if KS is zero, then the Goldstone mode is flat. If KS is not zero, you have a tilting.
You get a drift, not only a diffusion term of this Goldstone, but also a drift. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is in this regime.
But she has periodic boundary conditions in that direction. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically just the, everything is drifting around all the time. Mm-hmm. So you have a kind of Galilean invariance. Does not seem to be helpful.
Yeah, but I think for this KBZ physics, really of high relevance. For example, if you add to this equation, I mean, actually, I don't see how that would be.
So I appreciate that we are considering a model which we are not clear whether KPZ physics is relevant or not.
Yeah,
this is the work in progress at the moment, because we would have to actually first derive the phase equations here, see whether anisotropy is so strong that it doesn't matter, or maybe it's not strong enough and it matters, but there could be also other terms coming from the current. So actually, we don't know whether KPZ is important here or not. We might know in the future, but But numerically, that's what we find.
If you look at KPZ by Galilean frame, you see the Greek.
Let's just this conversation. Jake, last question, and then.
So, a lot of this beautiful physics arises, it seems, from the particular dispersion matching conditions that you're able to achieve between momentum and energy. So, if you look to what happens when you substantially detune the exciton from the cavity, such that the sort of crossing doesn't occur at A equals zero, but it occurs in a ring.
Tune exciton from photon, or
so I have the smile, and the flat line. They come in touch on resonance, but now of course I can move the smile down, so that the flat line representing the exciton passes through in a ring, rather than at a point. And there I have more options in matching, right? You can think of this like implant process for the phonons. And I'm very curious if you go beyond just this U1 to something.
We haven't looked.
I try to avoid it as much as possible.
But also another thing is actually, connecting to what Sebastian said, is that you can also try to pump on the ring, and then you wouldn't have a drift, because all your currents will be so kind of, you can go out of this drift problem if you want it. And it's possible actually in experiments to pump it like that. In Luis Vigna, I don't know what, I think he never published the results, but he obtained OPO pumping on the ring.
Also, yeah. Bramati has done it for spontaneous conversion. Actually, you find not just stripes, because if one looks at Magena's images in real space with interference of pump signal and idler, one sees a kind of charge density wave structure. If one goes into the regime that you, Jake, are mentioning, you can get the checkerboard, you can get hexagonal states, so you have more, a higher group, which is potentially broken.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the intuition, but I...
It's perfectly true, but it's very complicated, very unstable, experimentally hard.
Also, the technical details, we are also pumping always below to be in optical limiter regime, not optical bistability regime, because that also could complicate things. So you can, if you want, complicate life. I mean, there is lots of space to that system. And they can look at this experimentally. So if you discover something interesting, I'm sure there are lots of experiments.
I wanted simplicity. I just turned the laser off. So.
Okay.
Okay. I'm just complicated.